Hi, I'm Nina Schacht.
And I'm Jane Shake.
And you're listening to Gut Talks.
Double G, U, double T.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maria, and welcome to Gut Talks, double G, U, double T, a podcast I started to connect, reconnect, and meet like-minded individuals and put some karma on the board. In this episode, we put together an existing segment of season 3. So instead of listening in batches, you get to listen to the entire conversation. We had over 89,000 downloads to date, starting from zero, with no sponsors, and it's a 100% self-funded podcast. Thank you so much for hanging around and listening to the episodes. And I have one ask only. I'd love to have your feedback to keep the show up to your expectations, so drop me a line at maria@gut.com, WGUWT.com. And like, share, or leave a review if you can. Now let's get started.
I'm looking forward to this episode with you, Nina Schacht and Jane Shake. I just like to try to pronounce different names. Like last week, I had like Jacob from Denmark. So that was also trying to figure out how to pronounce the name. Not big new, it's nuances more than anything. So I'm looking forward to this because you're both in the research space. So we're going to deep dive into that. You both have a background in psychology. You're both into theater. And that's how we met, actually, using theater for service design. So we met in person. So that was nice. And I was just intrigued and interested in your profiles, like both of you. And it just so happened that you're both in Berlin. And I thought, you know what, let me ask you two to be together on the podcast. So this is like completely unscripted. We don't know exactly what we're going to talk about, but we know that it's going to be about research, why it's important, who is it important for, things like that. But we're going to go through stories because you have lots of interesting stories that you shared when we met. So let's get into it. But before, I want to get started a bit just to get to know you a bit more, even though we've seen each other in like ridiculous situations trying to do stuff like acting like right? But I mean, I don't know who wants to go first, but I want to ask about who were you as a kid, a teenager, growing up? What is it that got you to where you are today? And don't take this as a very like, in terms of like extremely deep levels of, you know, understanding, but are there moments that you can recall that you reflect on today that make you think, okay, I was that kind of kid, I did this, and now it's all making sense?
That's a tough one. Jane, do you want to start?
I can actually, because it's something that I have often thought about, because when we might come to later, the job that Nina and I both do is something that a lot of people kind of end up accidentally. Mm-hmm. So you think back, how did that happen and why do I enjoy my work so much? And I think I was the oldest of four children. So and my mom was the kind of person who was very unpredictable. I'm going to put it this way. There was, and I think I learned very, very early on how to read people. I think it was something that I had to learn, that I learned as a kid. And when, maybe I don't know whether it's something that you're kind of, you're born with to a certain extent, or whether your socialization kind of throws you into situations where it's good, you know, it's a good survival strategy to be able to read other people and to read the room. So it's kind of something that always has been part of my life. I think I was aware of it quite early. And then another thing that has always bothered me, I can really remember some moments. I have a very strong memory of being about 13, 14, waiting in the country. We lived in the country. We moved to the country when I was 12. So I was like dislocated from the capital city of Scotland to the middle of nowhere. And I remember standing waiting for the school bus and having an argument with the other girl that was standing waiting with me. And I remember just thinking, how did we get here? What can you study to figure this out? Why do people always end up fighting? Why do people never understand each other? You know, why is this all this human stuff so hard? And I also have a very, very strong sense of justice. And also, I think connected to, I'm going to finish this last sentence, why I ended up in the business I'm in now, I also have this really strong urge to explain myself all the time. I always feel you have to, you know, and I also felt that we were often being unjust to one another, because what I, even as a child, I really, really hated it when somebody said, you did that because, or you did that to annoy me, or why did you do this? or why did somebody do that? Well, of course she did that. She's that kind of person. And I always felt, no, that cannot be the truth of the matter. That people mix up what I learned later in my studies were states and traits. But I always felt that there was such a lot of injustice around pointing fingers, putting people in boxes, saying you only did that because. And I was really aware that it must be more complex.
Thank you for that. Just so you know, I started asking this question on like during season 3, and I find it always fascinating just to get to know people more. And because lots of things you were saying, I can relate to because I overthink. One of the things that made me realize that I tend to overthink is when I see a mosquito or a dog, I wonder, what's the point of your life? You know what I mean? So, Nina, I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, well, welcome to the Club of Overthinkers. I think I'm an overthinker as well. I think my story was rather, let's put it that way, as Jane puts it, I think everyone I know who's working in our industry, it's coincidence. No one ever, you know, like planned to go into that direction. And I was always the child that I think was the diplomatic person, bringing persons together. I can't find the right words right now. And I've been standing in front of groups quite early. You know, it's just like, okay, I don't know, stop fighting, or hey, we want to reach this goal. Why don't we do it this and that way? So I, not in the sense of a leader, but rather in the sense of being the facilitator kind of groups. And I guess that's what I'm still doing nowadays. So I think that's how my loop closes from how I started, where I came from, and what I'm doing today.
Thank you for that. And I like also the fact that you mentioned, so thinking about it, you realize that lots of people in the industry or in that space actually got pushed or propelled into that area kind of by mistake, you're saying. Before we delve like deeper, I know that could last for 3 hours, like, but what is user research like in a nutshell? Who wants to attempt?
I don't know if we know.
Don't know if we have the answer.
It's one of those things where you can give different answers for one question, right?
Yeah, and I think just also as a background, actually, Jane and I were initially coming from market research. And I don't know whether you follow the discussions. However, there are unfortunately big discussions going out there. What is the difference between market research, user research? Is it the same? Is it similar? Where is the overlap? And I think there are whole conferences about that. So it's, let's put it that way. I have a very strong opinion on it. However, I tend to fight with people.
Go for it. I know you have user research / market research. Sometimes I just put in the same bucket and sometimes
yes.
Completely different. So yeah, let's go for it. We want strong opinions.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I like to cross out the first word, you know, being it UX, market research, whatsoever. I always say I'm a researcher, meaning I'm following standards, I'm following methods, I'm trying to maintain quality. And for me, let's put it that way, the only difference between user research and market research is the item or the thing I'm studying. However, what I'm doing for me doesn't really make the difference. So user research for me is rather about studying the digital product, whereas market research is rather studying the physical product. And yes, there are big arguments going on, like, okay, but market research, doesn't it rather also feed into physical products, but also into a different point in the life cycle of a product? Whereas user research quite often is rather seen as in the beginning, development, and market research also goes strongly into a product is already alive. We do have a campaign out there. We're talking about marketing and all these kind of things. And that's something that user research actually doesn't cover. But for me, it's a question of, hey, I'm using the same methods. I'm just jumping in at different points into the life cycle of a product, being it digital or physical.
And Jane, I mean, this podcast is audio, but also we do lots of video snippets. We're going to be doing more now. So I could see your head like...
My body language.
Exactly. So I'm gonna be putting this as video because I just loved it. You're just like moving, like, okay, what's going on her mind?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything Nina said, and it is. I think it's a discussion that is totally superfluous. You know, trying to decide, because same as Nuna said, I consider myself a researcher, and maybe my path into and through research, I've been doing this for decades. Honestly, yeah. Decades was a different one than people who today call themselves UX researcher. But I think, I'm not sure, I've got really bored of the conversation. And at the end of the day, we're people, our jobs are to understand people, other human beings. I mean, I haven't, unfortunately, not had the opportunity to do research yet with many animals, but it may happen. So our job is to understand the human condition, in which sounds really big, but of course, depending on what the, you know, what our customers need. I mean, I always say that my job is to help my customers understand their customers better, full stop. And I think a user researcher or a UX researcher would also sign that. So, and we're also using the same methods. And I think when Nina made is a distinction between digital and physical products, that's where I felt uncomfortable. Because as I was working, when I started in whatever you want to call it, we used to call it market research. Then we called it insights. Then we called it consumer research. Then some people called it marketing research. And then suddenly it was like there was this whole new, you know, group that was kind of growing in parallel. They called themselves user researchers. But back in when the first agency that I worked with, we were doing a lot of testing in the digital sphere because it was, you know, we were like, how does this medium work? What's this www thing? How can we change, you know, how does that change the way people get information? How does it change the way people interact with brands and products? So today, I think people have a lot of apps and tools and they work on purely digital products. But I remember with my boss back then at Sommer Research in Mannheim, we made this crazy setup because suddenly we had this urge to, we were getting asked by our clients, oh, we're making a website. Oh, cool, you're making a website. And yeah, we want to understand about the interaction of our customers with this. And if you can remember what websites looked like in the 0 years.
Yeah.
But yeah. Still, it was so what our customers came to us because we were the only people who were doing research. It was the sort of the time when the German Online Research Society was founded. So it started to kind of grow in a different direction. But we built real apparatus, like we connected computers and screens and audio devices so that we could actually watch people were interacting with these clunky websites in real time and record them, and the clients could watch them remotely. Hello, hello, dear people, 2023. We were doing this in 2000. And I remember that my boss was like, oh my God, how can we make it work in sync it so we can watch in real time? And then he sent me to the university to go to the music room, to the production studio where you could, like, there was all this material. And he told me to get this instrument, some kind of, I don't know what you call it, a modulator, something that makes music when you know, synchronizes and modulates different musical instruments and input, output. And we put that in between all the computers and we made this thing. I mean, we were talking about these computers with the, like, they take up all your desk, the ones, you know, with a desktop and the monitor. So we were, and that's something that, although it makes me feel really old, like, to think about it, at the same time, when I hear people talking about, you know, user research, UX is only digital and market research is only physical, and I'm like, wait a minute. And since then, we've always been involved in digital, and I think, I really don't know where I would make a distinction. I don't really have a lot of experience in doing what the UX researchers do, so I'm not really the right person to talk about it. But that was just my take on, you know, and I think we have the same questions. We answer the same questions. What motivates people? What's their need state? What are the barriers for people to do something, to not do something? How can we facilitate enabling people to do stuff? We use frameworks like Jobs to be Done. We use the same, you know, methods. And we were in market research. We were using methods that now have been, like, packed into brand, well, it's almost a brand, into methods like design thinking or lean startup. But we were doing that. I'm not trying to show off here. I'm just saying we were doing that. And I remember when the design thinking hype kind of went off, I was like, oh, what's this? This is really interesting. And I went to some workshops to find out. And I was like, yeah, okay. So they're iterating concepts and they're doing, I don't know what we used to call it, building prototypes, using personas. I said, yeah. That's nice. Nice that the software people are doing that now too.
Jane went further into it because, like as I said, I made the distinction between, for me, digital and physical projects or products, and you've went further into like that. You tested those hilarious 2000 websites. So that was also my thing, because I had the feeling, of course, as a market researcher, I always took digital influence into account. You know, like, because we all live in a digital world. But I have to admit, in my market research world, I never tested any digital product. So that was kind of where my finger raised. And then Jane said, like, I'm like, wow, okay, that's an experience I never had. As a market researcher, as a UX researcher, yes.
Okay, so basically, it's one of those words where you have this distinction between, I'm going to put it here, you have design thinking, service design, customer experience. Some see this as, like, I would say almost silos, and some say it's all the same, like the goal is the same. So again, I don't think there will ever be a consensus on what it's going to be, because it's going to be different for different people based on their experiences. But the word research itself is, I used, because obviously part of what I do, I also do like this part when it comes to projects. So, and I enjoy it, I must say. I mean, I think the best, what I enjoy the most is actually this part, because you learn so much, actually. You gather so much that you can share again over time, not just once, because it's like, I remind you that, you know, we found this. Like, but what I was saying here is using the word research, qualitative research, ethnographic research, UX research, market research, and it becomes like a bit difficult. And I'm gonna quote this, as you were talking, actually, Joe Pine, who came also on my podcast, I think in season 2 or 1, he mentions that there are no markets, there are customers.
There are no markets, there are no customers, there are people.
Yeah, there are humans.
Yes, because what is a customer? What is a user? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is a user? Yeah. I know, I mean, the term user, really, that's what people call drug addicts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and coming back to that point, I really don't understand why these strange silos, borders are built. Because I feel we all have the same goal, and we could rather profit from each other, because a lot of things I'm seeing in user research right now, I'm thinking, well, we've been there 20 years ago. Just ask us. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You're not the first researchers on the world. But there is like an industry that's been doing that for, I don't know, 50 years, 60 years. Just talk to us. We might be helpful.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyone can reach out to you, I guess. And that's the thing, like, to be honest, also, when I met you, I was like, you've been doing that for, like, I'm not going to say centuries, but let's combine this.
Feels like centuries sometimes.
Like everyone in the room, right? And it's like this trendy thing right now.
Is it? Yes. Okay, maybe I can tell you a story. And I really love that story. Because I think it must have been, oh gosh, I think 5 years ago or something, I went to user research, it might have even been just design, but meetup in Berlin. And they had an interesting topic. I went there, just went into freelancership, didn't know anyone, sat down, guy sitting next to me. We chatted. He was a designer. And then he asked, oh, what are you? I'm like, oh, I'm a researcher. Like, okay, what else do you do? Well, I'm a researcher. And, you know, and I told him, like, well, I worked for Research International, TNS, Kantar, you know, like naming all these companies. He's never heard of any of them. And he's like, so what do these companies do? I'm like, research. And he's like, there are companies out there that just do research. And I'm like, yes. And I'm just a researcher. And he was just like, wow, I didn't know. And I found that really eye-opening, because I was dipping my toes into a scene where there were designers that did some research, but the idea of, what, you just do research? I'm like, yeah, that's great. I love it. That was new. I still like to tell that story.
But that was like 5 years ago. And that, yes, it was not that trendy just yet. It was getting there. Yeah.
But I think, to be fair, that there are a lot of people working in, let's just call it market research, that, you know, so that drawer that we might call market research, who have managed to exist in a parallel world to the UX and the innovation yes. world that Nina and I have dabbled in, because I think we saw the proximity to what we were doing and we were interested to see what was happening on the other side of the fence, you know, and that it took for the more classical back, not maybe today, they're catching up. I think every research agency or company that has a qualitative department at least is working with more agile methods today. There is a discussion starting rather late in the market research community about agility, about diversity, about equality. But I think that still a lot of researchers kind of, that it is like two tracks, you know, two railway tracks yes. sort of going yes. You know, I'm not really meeting. And Nina and I met for some reason, maybe I mean, I was fascinated by the idea, and I do admit that when I heard that software developers were doing research, I was like, oh, fuck, you've got to get, like, oh, shit, you've got to stop them doing that. They can't do that. They don't know how to do it. Stop it. Stop it. They're going to break everything. You know, I really had that arrogance as a researcher until I dove more into it, the whole, like, startup community and lean startup and design thinking and what people like SAP were doing, and then realized, well, actually, yeah, some of them can do it really, really well, and started to pick. You know, there are mm-hmm. things like, for example, for startups, the book I always recommend them to read is The Mom Test by Rob Fitzpatrick, who comes from that side, that world, and has just nailed it in terms of what they should be doing.
A lot of interesting topics here, Jane, because I feel there is a lot of great research going on. I'm absolutely on the same track. There are two tracks running, and probably my story 5 years ago, a designer who said, I'm doing research, meeting a market researcher, which would have said, what? You're doing research? Doesn't exist. I think it would have worked the other way around. Another interesting thing I think you just talked about was the research democratization. So what we really see right now is that it's going away from this specialist skill, people just being research, it being a specific department also within startups, moving more into the direction of like, hey, let's all do more research, aka conversations with humans who might not use our product. So I think there are a lot of things going on there right now.
It's interesting though that you said there are two parallel worlds. I'm not pinpointing here or anything, but are there researchers in their own bubble, or
yes,
is it okay?
Yes.
Why?
Maybe their bubble is not transparent enough that they can actually see what's happening. I think that there may be like accidental bubbles, mm-hmm. not. And I think that there is, at least for some of the big organizations, the larger research organizations, not so much for smaller like boutique agencies, but more the larger organizations, some of the companies, maybe Nina, you could say more about this because you've worked with some of these companies. I don't know if it's still true that the market and for Germany, I can only say this for Germany, the market research business is very traditional, quite conservative. It's big money, and the qualitative part, Nina and I are qualitative researchers, and you have to imagine that qualitative research is only a tiny little part of market, what we would call market research. Mm-hmm. So the qualitative research is also in the market research world treated with a bit of condescendence. So, you know,
we are the crazy ones.
Yeah, we're the ones that we just talk. We just talk to people. We don't, it's not mm-hmm. based, you know, and for a long, long time, and this is also something that is, thank God, starting to change, the two worlds of quant and qual were kind of not talking to each other. So you would have some people were doing only quant research, some people were doing only qualitative research. You never really worked together. There was a kind of feeling, if you do qual, you can't do quant. If you do quant, you can't do qual. And so again, that is also something where the silos, in my opinion, they should be broken down, because we all know as researchers, everybody who's studied it and everybody who knows the, you know, like Nina said, we are science-based what we do, that you can, the best results are when you use different methods to look at the same problem. Yeah. But I think that because the industry itself is very traditional, and I personally, as a freelancer or somebody who has usually mainly worked in small agencies, in like boutique agencies, and never only just very short period in the market research department of a larger organization, I never felt part of this industry. You know, there are bodies, there's the ASOMAR body that governs marketing and social research worldwide. But when you go to, like, I don't know, maybe that has probably all changed. I'm probably talking a lot of rubbish and it's a lot of stereotypes, but it's my perception. A lot of people in suits, very expensive conferences, where people talk down to you from a stage and have lots of PowerPoints. And I always felt that that's not my world. And that could, mm-hmm. and maybe I could, you know, if that is market research, yeah, then I can totally understand why that bubble exists and there's very little communication with the UX world.
Yeah, and I would like to add to it, I think there's a lot of prejudices. And I realized that I'm working with that because, I mean, just as a background, I did lead the UX research department for one of the largest e-commerce platforms in Germany. And I did build a UX research department from scratch for a startup. I never mentioned that I'm a market research in that area because they don't like market researchers because they have the feeling market researchers, they only do quantitative research. They're number crunchers. They're slow and they can't do this agile, fast, insight digging that is needed. When I'm talking to companies who want market research, I don't mention that I also do UX research because, so, you know, so it's kind of like where I'm going. All right. I know, sorry, please don't tell. So that's the end of my freelancership. No, but it's interesting because like when I talk to the companies who want market researchers, they say like, okay, UX researchers, they just test whether the button is supposed to be green, red or yellow. They can't do real research. So I'm like, depending on where I am, I use different terms on what I'm doing, but I'm doing the same.
Is it helping not putting you in a box or is it helping you build the team you want to build or you get the job you want to get or the project you want to get?
I feel when I'm working on these jobs or with these teams, I don't need to dive down the rabbit hole of these discussions. I go on stage, I talk on conferences about that topic because I think that's for me where it belongs. But I, you know, if I do a project with a client, I don't need to be this, okay, let's talk about UX versus market, blah, blah, blah. I deliver what you need and I don't mind which label you put on it.
It's funny that you said that because I realize I also live a double life. Yeah, it's shocking. As I do when I work for my research clients, they book me because I'm a qualitative researcher. I do ethnographic research. I'm just this week I've been doing ethnographic research, dashing around Berlin, talking to teenagers about fashion and how TikTok influences what they, you know, what sneakers they buy. It's such great fun. But I also work on more like innovation projects, design thinking projects, design sprints, but I do that in a different bubble. I just realized that when Nina was talking, They're not the same people. I coach startups. I bring a lot of my research competence into the startup world. And for people who are just like starting out, I do like pro bono workshops for female founders, that kind of thing, where I try to bring what I learned on projects with massive budgets for, I mean, to be honest, it still is market research, still is a lot of FMCG, you know, big budget. I try to bring that into that world, but they don't talk to each other, the two worlds, you know, and I do this because it's more fun, to be honest. It's much more fun to work like design thinking in schools. I do that. It's a charity I work with. Where we use all, so I try to use the stuff that I do to earn money. I try to, you know, to use that in other contexts to experiment and to see how far I can go and to bring some of that into another, you know, into a different kind of a culture. But at the same time, it's really strange that we're both living these double lives.
So I have to admit, I don't mind. I mean, coming back to your questions, like, it sounds like I gave up. No, it's like, I don't mind how you call what I'm doing, you know?
Yes.
I know what I'm doing, so.
Exactly.
And maybe in 3 years, there is a new term coming out where I think like, oh, yeah, actually, now as you say, I'm doing that as well, so.
We used to call it insights for a while. I don't know what happened to that.
I don't know.
I didn't realize that it was really a big topic, actually, in that space. But that's interesting, like we went into it. But the only thing that I don't really get is you were saying that researchers tend to be, especially in big companies, that might not be as big out there. Like you said, Nina, like this guy who asked you, like, what do you do? Like, are there research companies that do research? You know, I mean, one of the key, if you want, qualities of a researcher is just to be curious. So how is this bubble not transparent? That's something that I'm curious now. I just to explore, like, why
everything is digital. And you could imagine that if these market research people there, the market research companies and the UX people, that they must meet, you know, yeah, because they're all on LinkedIn and they're all good. But the really strange thing is that they don't. And I don't think it's any kind of, I don't think it's deliberate. I don't think it's like a no. deliberate kind of, you know, we don't talk to them. And it's really interesting. It just doesn't happen. So you can see how even in the, maybe even more in the digitalized world where it's easier to stay in your bubble, I don't think it's anybody is driving it. I think it's a kind of a dynamic that has happened, and it has to be. If we wanted to change it, then we would have to be very active to change it. But I don't know.
Good question. Why don't we do it? Because if we say one of our main things is curiosity and there seems to be something really interesting out there, why doesn't that happen? Good question. Can't tell.
We people too. Market researchers are also people. So where we know that there's curiosity, but at the same time, there is fear of change, fear of the new. Yeah. It's always, you know, I think the market research industry is trying to reinvent itself, but it's doing that in its bubble with its clients.
Yes. So just in a nutshell, how did you get out of the bubble somehow?
Yeah. Well, for me, it was the design thinking. I think about, okay, I don't know if it was 10 years ago or I don't know, whenever. I was working in a market research agency in Mannheim, or was it later than that? No, I think I was already self-employed. When you're I think this is something that maybe Nina, you might agree with as well. When you're self-employed, you have to get out of your bubble.
Yes,
you can't. You have to. I mean, I was living in this little town in the middle of nowhere and working on projects and all the time thinking, oh my goodness, I feel so isolated. So I would just like go to meetups, and I would go to meetups on things that I'd never heard of, like DevOps, just to find out what it is. And this is how I discovered like Lean Startup and design thinking and the whole innovation thing that was like happening. And then I realized that there was a lot of that in there that I was already doing, not all of it, but we were already doing parts of the innovation process. And then I got interested in the other parts, you know, to join the dots. But I also have one of those brains that is just, oh, there's a squirrel.
Well, and actually my stepping out of the bubble, design thinking similar, it was just, well, back then it was a trend, blah, blah, everyone did it. So I was onto that track as well. The interesting thing is rather, I think, how I got into UX research. Because remember that conversation with the designer where he's like, oh, you're just doing your research? And I don't know, half a year later, or maybe a year later, that person recommended me to an agency because that agency was looking for an interim manager for their UX research team. So person I never heard about reached out to me and UX research team. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, I'm the wrong person. I can't do UX research. How can I lead a team of UX? And that person was a researcher himself. And he said like, oh, don't worry. You know, there is no fence between you. You can do that. I'm like, I had to look up what is UX research before going into that phone call, you know. And I ended up leading that team, I think, for 8 months. You know, entering by not even knowing what the term means. So that's how my fence got torn down.
It goes back to lots of industries, actually, where you have this kind of also generalist approach, but you have lots of things that happen, but just packaged in different ways over time. It's also, I think some of us teach here, but, you know, you have new master degrees, so you need to have new fancy titles to attract new students or new job titles to attract more people to apply. But this job description is like 1,000 things that actually sometimes don't match, or it's impossible to be great at everything. So it reminds me of that. So yeah, I think we dived into that as well. I was taking some notes as you were talking. So I think let's have a wrap up of this section somehow. And people who are like listening to this conversation who are in the space, like the innovation space, let's say in general, but also research, like particularly, or someone who wants to switch around because you have researchers who come from different backgrounds and like jump in because they understand specific industries, maybe even more in depth or not. I don't know. How can someone get into the space? Does it require a specific background? What are the skills?
I just remembered how when my very first job interview, when I came to Germany, I was working in London and I hated it. I wanted to become a management consultant. I was so young and I said,
more
I'm going to be a
suits.
management consultant. Yes. And I realized pretty quickly that that wasn't my career path. So I just came, I came to Germany and I applied for some jobs. And I applied for Procter & Gamble because I studied marketing and I kind of heard of them. So I went to Procter & Gamble for a job interview and they said, we've got two jobs that we'd be interested in, you know, putting you forward for. One is market research and one is media. I had no idea what media did. I had no idea what a media department did. But I said then and there, I said, no way I'm going into market research. I'm not going to do that. So I did media. I think I often have these discussions. I remember with a lot of qualitative researchers, whether what we do is something that is born or taught. I think there is a certain kind of capacity for, like I said before, reading people. I don't want, there's that awful word empathy that gets thrown around. I don't like it so much. But I think we have an, let's just talk about qualitative research right now, because neither of us are statistics and we're not, we can work with quant people, but we don't, it's not our predominantly what we do. I think this curiosity that you talked about earlier, just a kind of a sort of the feeling that it's not as clear cut as you might think it is. People don't act the way they do in because of a specific, they're not trying to, you know, people always act the way they do for some kind of inner motivation. It wouldn't be interesting to know what that is. I think this is something that you have to have, this kind of acceptance of the fact that, because, you know, there are people who think in totally different ways. I think you really need to have that. I mean, I work with a lot of juniors in this space and you kind of notice quite early on if you're working with somebody whether they have that. And I know this is not an answer to the question, but I think I can't really say, go and study this, go and study that, because I've met so many great researchers from so many different backgrounds. I think it is very useful to have, and this is something that I think is a debate in the UX field. I think I maybe have heard of this, to have a base in social sciences so that you understand some models. It could be psychology, it could be sociology. In some cultures, they have a lot of anthropologists. In France, a lot of qualitative researchers come from social anthropology. So you have a basic understanding of some cognitive models. How do people function individually and in groups to have that grounding? Doesn't mean you have to have a master's in psychology, but it's very good to have come from that area. I think also it's very useful when you're working with, whether you're working with internal clients or with external clients, to have some business acumen. I think it's very important to be able to talk to marketing people, product development people, to have an understanding of their roles. And you can learn that on the job, but to have a, I mean, that was something that really helped me at the beginning of my career, was that I'd spent several years at P&G and I could speak marketing. What do you think, Nina?
Yeah, absolutely on the same page with anything related to sociology, psychology, and so on. I feel here we are again at two very different tracks of how market researcher versus UX researcher enter the area. Market research classically is, well, you do have some kind of study background and you enter as a junior and there's a lot of learning on the job, shadowing seniors and really learning it there. Whereas with the UX research, I do see an increase of boot camps, of all these kind of things. So
yeah.
UX researcher come from there. Or not everywhere, but with a lot of universities, when you study design, you do have a little bit of a research track in there. So that's also a possibility. But that's only, how to say, the springboard, how to get in. And afterwards, I can just say, just do it. It's learning on the job, because it's so much, it's not about theory, but it's so much about, reading the room, understanding what's going on there. And it's very difficult to have like a 10-point checklist of saying, oh, I have to be able to do that. But yeah. Go out there, do it.
This is what actually I was asking you this question, and in a way where not just someone entering, but I'm seeing lots of people, primarily on LinkedIn and, you know, Reddit or some places, people just want to switch their career path, like go into UX, go into something else. So I was asking, like, some backgrounds can be very useful also. It's not just like, you know, you have to start from like scratch, or you can shift also. So that was, thank you for that answer.
Yeah, sorry, the one thing I think that we must, I think that I personally think is very, very important in our job is language, because we spend most of our time talking to people or reading things they've written or listening to their posts. You know, we use all the media today. It's not just interviews or focus groups. Are we allowed to say that word? Focus groups. I think having a feeling for language is very, very important. I would always be very careful. Although I speak German, I feel okay to work in Austria, but I would, depending on the topic, I would get a local moderator, depending on, even though I come from the UK.
Me too. For Austria, Switzerland, sorry, I would not moderate.
And even some topics, I would be careful of even working in the UK if it's something where they're talking a lot about what's happening right now in terms of, I don't know, celebrities and stuff, because I just don't know. I don't live there anymore. Yeah, so feeling for language is very, it's very useful.
I'm gonna just switch this a bit around and ask you, you mentioned, why are you not allowed to say focus groups?
I didn't know this until recently.
I personally, I'm not a fan of focus groups, but that's personally what I'd like to hear. Why are you not allowed?
I don't really know, actually. I just got told that by somebody who was not a researcher.
Okay.
And apparently something has happened while I've been busy running focus groups all across the country. And Lina and I have literally spent thousands of hours of our lives wasted
in
on focus groups.
Yeah. Yes, they're out. And I don't know what happened. And the thing is, and there maybe we're coming back to the loop of research democratization. Because I think a thing as a seasoned researcher you're all also able to do or must be able to do is realize, okay, for which topic do I choose which method? And I think focus groups were burned, being used too much for the wrong topic. And then it's just frustrating if you have a topic which needs a one-on-one interview or which needs ethnography and you think, oh, I think it's cheaper if I just put 10 people in one room and chat with them for 2 hours. You can't do anything with the results. So I think that happened, you know, too many people thought like, oh, that looks good, seems cheaper, more time efficient, let's do a focus group on topics which just doesn't belong. But that's just an hypothesis.
Can I throw something here to support you in your question? Is it also because it's been used and overused maybe as a buzzword by people who don't really understand how to conduct the research, and this is how it got burned somehow?
It's really, I mean, moderating a focus, we don't call them focus groups actually, we call them group discussions. Mm-hmm. Moderating group discussions is, when I started working in this, it was the, what would you say, the queen's discipline for qualitative researchers. You don't get to do that for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And it is not easy. And you have to practice. And I think back on my first moderator, you know, my jobs doing focused group discussions, it is so embarrassing to think about what I did to those people. But you just have to, and it's very difficult to teach. So you have to spend hours and hours and hours. And I was very lucky that I spent a lot of time in the middle of my career working on projects together, sometimes with French moderators and sometimes with people from the UK who have very different styles and very different approaches. So it's not like there's not one way to do it. So I'm getting feedback from your clients who would come to me at the end of the session and say, yeah, that worked really well, but we've had really good experience doing this. Or why don't you try that? That's how you learn it. And also, I think maybe what burnt focus groups is there's a kind of a trend for a while of using focus groups like some kind of quant. Going around the room and asking people on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think about this? And then writing it on the flip chart. Hello, that's not qualitative research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you're not a fan of focus groups, you should watch one of us moderate one.
Okay.
Because we still do it and we still get paid for it.
Yes. Okay. And there is such a big difference out there in the quality of focus group moderation. There is.
But that is a good slip of the tongue, Nina, because you can run a, what people, you know, focus group like a workshop. You could run a workshop like a focus group. I think, you know, what I think of a focus group discussion is, I have the luxury of having these people, maybe not even in a room, but on my screen for 2 hours, and I can just, like, you know, work with that.
Mm-hmm. How do you recruit your participants then?
This is not a nice topic.
that's the topic that hurts most, let's put it that way. There is an entire industry that helps you recruit the people we talk to. So there are data banks where people sign up and like, hey, I'm basically interested in. So that's like the standard. What's been grow, and then I have to say, throw in my criteria, you know, from what's growing in the last years is this, that more progressive agencies try to build their own pool of different kind of users. Because what happens quite often in these data banks, well, you have people in there who just do it to get some money, and they might even fake, oh yes, I own this and that car, but they just don't. So what's been going on is that trying to recruit via an own pool, you know, you say like you need very specific influencers or whatsoever, trying to recruit via Insta or Facebook, saying like, hey, would you like to chat with us about your whatsoever, depending on the topic, that works quite well. Because the thing is, when people hear market research or research, even UX research, and participating, like, oh my gosh, that sounds so boring. But the thing is, we most of the time want to talk to people who are interested in that topic. And those people love talking to us because they love the topic. So you just need to find those people and putting them on the right topic, kind of. There is a lot of online recruiting going on right now with all these startups who do recruitment for UX reader, for UX research. That's, I think, the spectrum of what we're working with.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one because also sometimes you call people maybe not at the right time, but then they give you a few minutes and then you're like, okay, I wish I had longer, but then they have other things going on. Like, why do you have to, they have to do that? That's if like they're the right people, right? And if they're, so it's tough. Like, do you have to do so much to get so little?
I think it really, I mean, when we, I'm going back again to the early 2000, whatever, when we were working this small agency, recruiting was something that we more or less did ourselves. We would go out on the streets and put notes in people, on people's cars saying, we'd like to talk to you because we like your, you know, your car is interesting. We did a lot of research for automotive. Or we would ask around our friends, or we would put ads in the newspaper.
Wow.
Yeah, or we put signs up in the university if we were looking for that age group, and we would like recruit people on the street. It was very common to be stopped on the street and asked. And then the whole industry changed. And I still work with professional recruiting agencies, just selected ones, very few. But what I noticed there is that they always tell me that they're getting such a lot of pressure to put the prices down. So the quality cannot be good, regardless of the method. If people are not prepared to put money behind recruiting, but to have enough respect to say the person is going to spend, I don't know how many hours on the telephone to convince somebody to take part in a research project, and that person should get an incentive for doing that. If we're not prepared to put money behind that, then we will get rubbish.
Yeah.
It's garbage in, garbage out, and the industry has to be prepared to accept that. And I think
you can ask ChatGPT.
Ouch!
Oh, let's talk about Silicon participants. Ouch. Yes, go on. Let's talk about them. Let's not talk about them.
Absolutely not. No, it's interesting what you're saying. I mean, I remember a few years ago. So I was in Milan, and I stood on the street, like in Duomo. I went to Duomo, where you have like tourists and locals, like a mixture. And people would think that I'm a scam, or that I'm trying to ask for money. They just don't give you time. So what you could do, you're saying 20 years ago, even putting like a paper on someone's car, or I can't imagine this happening today with all the scams going on. I mean, I get SMS sometimes, and it's like, get your iPhone for $1, like things like that, you know. It's scam everywhere. Is it happening now?
I don't know because I pay other people to do it, I must admit. But I have done it myself. Yep. Like I've been, I remember it was before, I think before COVID is also a topic. Before COVID, yeah. When we did a lot more research in test studios and not online. For some projects, for specific clients who really want a specific target, and it's not just we're like testing the newest ad for a detergent or something, you know? But where I want people specifically, I do a lot of work in the fashion field. And I have been in cities, like I remember being in Munich, it was before COVID, and walking up to people on Marienplatz in Munich and saying, those are really cool boots. What are you doing this evening?
That's a pickup line, Jane.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, but I was like 20 years older than them, you know.
Why not?
Okay, I never did that.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Yes.
You've got guts, Jane, like in that sense. It's like just pointing at guts. So question here. you both said you're overthink, and welcome to over to the Overthinkers Club, right? So what's your relationship with your gut feeling?
Very strong relation. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to be such a good researcher. And there we are again with reading the room, because reading the room for me is mix of feeling, oh, something's going on here. You know, like, of course, there might be physical signs of people shrugging or, you know, smiling or whatsoever, but something like, oh, something is going on here. And then working with that. And I need the gut feeling to realize quickly, hey, you know, there might be a little treasure chest there. I have to follow that direction, or, you know, because I realized something changed in the room when talking about these kind of things. So very strong connection.
I mean, yes, in the professional context, definitely. And it was something that really fascinated me when I first started working in the industry, because I was working for this guy, a social psychologist, had his own agency, and I would go along to presentations and I'd seen the groups, I'd taken notes, and I'd been tagged along to the interviews and done the transcribing of the interviews, and he would stand up in front of the clients and say, duh. And I was like, where did that come from? Did he make that up? And then like 20 years later, I'm doing it. You know, so yes. It's this, yeah. And it's so difficult because I feel so sorry for people starting out in the industry, because I don't want to tell them that, you know, you just know. But in the rest of my life, I'm really good at taking really big decisions. I mean, at taking them, it doesn't mean that they're good decisions. Mm-hmm. I'm really bad at the little ones. Should I go to the gym first, or have breakfast, or shower? I take, and then 2 hours later, I'm like, what did I want to do? But I do. I have spent my life making big decisions, big life. Yeah, and it's always been from a sense of that's the only option I have is to move forwards.
Just been thinking about it, and I love it how you phrase that, Jane. I remember a thing that my senior back then in my early, I don't know, it was my first or second year, told me, because the thing was like, you know, group discussions. And my question was, how do I know when I stop asking? So you have the topic and ask, like, you know, like, I don't know, how do you like it, or blah, blah, whatsoever. And I was always like, because you have a specific time frame of 2 hours with these people, you have a lot of topics to cover. So how in the world do I, as a moderator, know, okay, there is nothing more to come, let's move on to the next topic, or that's it? And the answer of my senior was, when the chart is full. And what? And it's true. And honestly, and I can't phrase it better, because also I'm sitting in these groups and I realize, yeah, my chart is written, you know, while I have these conversations. And, you know, yeah, I'm writing the chart and I realize, okay, I have all my pros and cons, you know, okay, let's move on. And that's also, well, you can call it gut feeling. However, well, I'm a psychologist and I actually did a lot of work on intuitive decision making. And psychology is quite clear on that gut feeling is not emotional, but it's based on implicit experiences you made through your life, and you can just access it quicker than your brains. So gut feeling is not like this, oh, I'm feeling like, but it's just you can access this very quickly. So yeah, when the chart is full, you go to the next topic, and that's gut feeling based on experience.
On that note, though, I'll tell you when I started using my gut feeling. I think dictation in French, right? The French grammar is more complicated than like the English one or so on. So I was really good actually at dictation, but I would just trust my gut, like, yeah, this word should have an S at the end or not. But don't ask me about the grammar. I had no idea. Let's move a bit to the next topic. Again, I'm just taking notes based on what you're saying, but maybe in a nutshell, let's be quick on that one. I know it's important, but for startups and large organizations, not everybody is aware of research, why it's important. And it's not a, like, you do it once and then you move on for the next 100 years, right? So yeah, why is it important for the listeners who have companies, startups, SMEs, even freelancing, right?
Very quick answer. I think no company, no matter in which field, can exist without humans purchasing their product. So how can you have the idea of building a product without talking to those humans? That would be my very short answer on that one.
Yeah, you can't afford not to do research. And I think also we're seeing a shift in the way business works has changed. You know, deregulation, globalization, it used to be that companies could work like top down. You know, you start a company because you're very good at something. You know, you can build something. You're very good at it. And then you have the idea, everybody needs this. So I'm building it for everybody who needs it because I need it. And maybe that worked for a while. You know, that did work for a while when we had people making, you know, but it doesn't work anymore because your customers have so much choice. You know, they don't have to buy your product. If you're building, I always say to startups, the number one reason why startups fail is lack of product market fit.
Yes.
And absolutely. It has been proven several times. So, I mean, that's the answer, because you can't afford not to do it. And I always say to them, make sure you're not making a solution for a non-existent problem. So I think you need to have research to understand the everyday reality of the people that are supposed to be buying your product or service so that it can dock onto their needs. So you can't afford not to. And everything is faster. So what are you going to do? Are you going to build a product, throw it on the market and wait for it to fail and then start again?
Yeah. And raise more money if you
can. I'd rather fail in a focus group. I said it again. I'd rather fail in a focus group at a concept stage than build something that nobody wants.
But that's an interesting one here, because you have like so many times, I think it's a post I made on LinkedIn and you commented also on that. It's where you, so many times I actually ask startups and founders, is like, have you spoken to potential customers? Did you go out? Yeah. And then when you try to dig deeper, it's like they ask the neighbor or the other startup next to them or someone. And then it ended here. Whereas they move so fast as a startup, like they iterate all the time, right? Things change all the time. And the research is not up, like following.
It's very hard for them. So it is. I think we have to be a little bit not so strict. You know, obviously they should be doing it, but we have to accept the fact that it's difficult for them. This is why I've been working for the last sort of, I think maybe 8 years in the town I used to live in with the local business and innovation center and the university and the research institutes there. There are a lot of startups coming out of the academic field and technical, because we have a Fraunhofer Institute for software development and we have a technical university. So a lot of ideas are coming out of that. And it is very difficult for these people to, they've never learned it.
Yeah.
It's not that they don't, I think the problem is not so much that they don't understand the need, it's more that they don't have the skills. And it's our jobs to help them do that, to lower the threshold and to make it accessible for them and to like hold their hands. I do like things like in workshops, I get them to practice interviewing each other, just really basic stuff. Mm-hmm. Give them a fictional startup and say, right, I'm the CEO and I want you to interview each other and come back with some, you know, the new disruption, the big thing. And make it fun.
And they have so many other things to do also. So it's like, what are the priorities? Obviously, they need to get out there. And there's pressure because there's limited time, there's limited money.
Yeah. So. And also, just to add to that, I've often seen that business analytics was mistaken as research. So I'm going into startups and like, oh, we know everything about the user. I'm like, oh, cool. Who have you talked to? Oh, no. And then, you know, I've seen amazing dashboards where I felt like, well, you know, we know everything these people are doing on the website, app, blah, blah, whatsoever. But I was told, well, with that, we can only see what your users are doing with what you offer them.
Yeah.
But we don't know what they might do differently, what they wish, what they need, whatsoever. So that there is always a big mistake, like data analytics being research. It's not.
I think also because I think also like you, Maria, I teach problem-based learning at technical university. I'm not allowed to call it design thinking at the university. I teach that to engineers. And I realized then how the education system is not really preparing them for that kind of human-centered, open, taking risks. They're not always being a right answer. You know, the ambivalence that you need, the ambiguity at the beginning of the fuzzy front end of innovation where you don't know the answer and you need to find it out. So when I ask my students to do like research, so they do Google Forms and they try and dig out research, you know, data that is already available off the university computer. And I like, you know, no, you really have to go and talk to people. And it's so hard. But to crack that kind of mindset. And I think that it's not just a problem. I think as a society, I mean, I also work, I'm very interested in design and research in the public sector. Yeah. So we need as a society, and I think there is a movement, it's starting very slowly. Maybe this is just my bubble, but I hope it's not. A kind of an acceptance for the fact that it's okay to not have the answer to everything, even if you are the CEO or yeah. even if you are the minister for, and that you, nobody expects you to say this is how it works, but that it's actually you're a better leader if you say, let's research it, let's look at it, let's talk to the people.
On that note, actually, just to make you feel better, Jane, even design students who have like a background in design, like completely, what I witnessed is I have to like push them 100 times to get out on the street and interview people. And I was surprised by this one. I mean, you know, so it's not just like if design students find it hard, then the others will as well. So that's at least my experience, right? So interesting points here. I just want to have some room for stories also. So let's start with this one before we jump into a story, because this could lead us to some stories, funny stories, sad stories, amazing stories, up to you. I'll leave it to you. But how do you approach a project? And then maybe you can share some. I know you have great stories, but I'm letting you decide what you want to share.
One of the first questions I ask people is, before we get into the nitty-gritty of what they want me to do and how they think it should be done, is to always like take several steps back and to always like come back and say, okay, what is the business goal behind all of this? Let's just not talk about research. What do you really need to, what is the pain in the company or in the department? What will you do with the outcomes? Because this is something I've learned the hard way, because you spend a lot of time and energy on a research project, you come back and you present the results and they say, no, we can't do that. And the other one is, what have you done already? What have you already tried? So that would be the first thing I would do. Take a big step back and look at the whole thing from the higher level.
Good one. Not more to add. Yeah, okay. It's kind of contextualizing where everything's coming from. That would be about it. Yeah.
I'm not going to go into details like, are you working with their own teams and things like that? Because then we go too deep, I think, and mm-hmm. we can leave this mm-hmm. for another time. But do you have some stories you can share of like what happened? Some maybe using different methods, like things that happened that took you by surprise.
We get surprised every day.
Yes. Actually, I always kind of have this tiny little never started it project in my head, stand-up comedy with qualitative researchers, because I think we all have the craziest stories. I mean, because again, it's being out there with humans. I'm just thinking how I would prioritize. Emotionally, I find sometimes it really gets me when I realize about which topics people start crying in the interviews. But I realized the most emotional topic you can research, it's cat food. Every focus group, cat food. That surprised me so much, because you always have people in there who love their cats, who wanted to have, and for most of them, it's not their first cat. So they start talking about, you know, a cat that diseased. I think in all my cat food groups, I have people start crying. They get up, they hug each other, they show pictures of the cat. That really was like, wow, I didn't expect, very emotional topic.
Can I just interrupt you here and ask you, what, I feel you're getting emotional about, do you have a cat?
No, I don't. Oh, okay. I don't.
Okay.
But I'm getting kind of.
No, it's just to put it in perspective, was this a cat foods project, like specifically?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It was communication for cat food, you know? So what do we put on the cat food? Is it with chicken, with turkey, with blah, blah, blah? So it wasn't emotionally going in depth. I wasn't visiting the people at home, group discussions, 6 people in the room. We make a classic introduction round where just, hey, you know, and people start crying. And I'm just like, oh, okay. Good. And that happens every time I have cat food groups. I don't know, maybe it's about me, but that really surprises me.
Baby food is the same, you know. I've had fights in group discussions, real fights.
I had people harassing me really badly. Like,
the first time I had to throw somebody out of a group because they stood up and they started shouting at each other across the table. And it was about cars. Okay. And it was, again, it was a test. It was a really, really pretty boring communication test, which we do quite a lot in market research, because we work a lot. We used to do work a lot with ad agencies, and she was a BMW driver and he was a Mercedes driver. Never put them in the same room together.
And you're in Germany. Okay.
Yes.
So, but maybe also bringing some methods in there. I remember one study I really enjoyed is we were testing for a company that produced spirits, alcohol. It was about new flavors and I think also labels. So what we did to not have the classic setting, we built a pub crawl for them. So we rented a cocktail facility. We had a high class cocktail person there. And it was like I think we always had three or four people who also didn't know each other walking with us through the stations and, you know, and then also trying stuff, you know, and at the very end, they came to the cocktail bar and were allowed to, I think, wish for a cocktail, maximum of two ingredients, because it was also about like, how would you use it at home, blah, blah, blah. And so it was awesome, really great idea. People were quite drunk in the end. We had fun. I don't know whether the results were that reliable. It was really fun doing all this stuff.
Did we get to do some really cool stuff? I mean, I remember we once flew, I think, 40 German farmers to France to test tractors, and they had such a great time. Driving these tractors around and then, you know, coming in and talking about them. And a lot of them had never been out of Germany in their lives before. Some of them had never been on an airplane before.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, talking about France, one study I did, I really loved it. It was about the front design of washing machines. So really like, how do you perceive what it looks like, you know, high class, premium, whatsoever? So kind of to have the situation when you're running through the Technik Market and see the things from, I don't know, 10, 15 meters, which one do you go to? So it was clear we can't do that with printouts. So we had, I think, a total of 20 washing machines, you know, from quite cheap to really premium. And we did the research in Germany and in Paris. And I just remember I arrived at the facility in the morning and there was like a traffic jam all over the place. I was like, what's going on here? And then I came around the corner and saw like, oh gosh, that's my truck delivering my 20 washing machines. And the guys didn't like the idea of bringing them up. I think it was third floor, 20. I was just like trying to pretend to have nothing to do with it. I just walked by, went to the next cafe, had my croissant, thought like, oh, they're going to deal with that.
We make some really incredible setups. Just last week I was in Hamburg, and we've done quite a lot of automotive research, and one thing that the automotive companies do is what's called a car clinic. It's a special kind of research. So you have a big shed and you have like lots of different cars in the same category, and then you have the prototype. So it's all really, really secret, and people have to go through like security and no pictures and no, there wasn't even a clock on the wall. So I was like, how am I going to know? How am I going to time my interview? Because I wasn't allowed to take my watch. I wasn't allowed to take my phone. But gut feeling, Nina knows this as well. You know exactly when 2 hours are up, you know,
yes.
You just know.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah. And then there's so many funny stories about car clinics, because cars, not just in Germany, are such an emotional topic. And when people start getting to a prototype or a car or whatever, they start telling you things that you think, sometimes you think, oh God, you know, I really didn't want to know all this. So yeah. And thing that I think is also really surprising, what I really enjoy about the job, but sometimes it's very frustrating, is when you realize, I'm just going to say this for all the marketing people out there listening, how little a lot of people know, are in connection with their targets, with the people that are buying their stuff. How really they just are so confused when they see what I call the day-to-day reality of their customers. Because, I mean, I can understand that, because they spend all their time thinking about it and overthinking it. But we don't spend our lives thinking about, you know, what soap detergent am I going to buy tomorrow? So, and I remember we did this project for a company that makes these tabs for the dishwashers.
Yeah.
And we had it was a group discussion, but before the group discussion, we had done in homes. So we'd been to watch people loading the dishwasher, how they do it and everything. And they introduced this new tab, and it had, I don't know, five or seven stripes and a Powerball. And it was the non plus ultra of dishwashing. You know, there was this phase where they do more and more and more and more. And the client that was watching was the product developer. She was a chemist. And we were like talking about it in the group discussions, and the women were going, yeah. And then I said, well, you know, if this comes on the market, how would that change the way you use your dishwasher? What would you do? And they're like, no, nothing really. I would just put it in that thing, close it, put it on. And yeah, anything else? You know, what about, would you stop using anything else? And because, you know, they use the salt and the stuff to make it sparkly. And they're like, no. And the woman, she actually came out of the room where when you were doing offline focus groups, you have the client behind a one-way mirror. It's like a police station, and you are the other side with the respondents. And she actually came into the room, which is like, whoa, you know, she came into the room and she's like, and she like attacked me, and she says, they don't understand the product. So we went back, we had a little talk, and I mean, I'm sure both of you know why the women reacted the way they did. I don't know if it's still up to date. I was discussing this the other day with some other people. But if you don't put the salt and the clear stuff, the rinsing liquid in your dishwasher, lights go on and it makes noises and it complains. So you can make a tab with 20 stripes and 50 power bowls. It won't have any difference, because the reality of the people using the machines is a different one. And I think that's just a very rather old, but a very good example of how little things can make such a big difference, and how important it is to not just talk to people, but to actually get out and observe. So this is also something that startups can do. If you're scared of having like a conversation, it depends on your product, of course, but you can go and watch people. I'm a project about some kind of software for people to take account of the insurance that the company gives their employees. And the company, I was working for the insurance company, and they wanted to understand why people were not using the software. And I talked to all these people about the software and how you could use it and everything, and why. And they said, yeah, they used it, but they all had behind them in their offices wall-to-wall files. They printed everything out. And the insurance company couldn't understand, because the USP of this platform was that you was paperless. But
so all you the offices, came after they developed the...
No. People were using the platform that was supposed to create paperless office, but mm-hmm. they were still printing everything out. And this is something that you can tell people that, mm-hmm. but you have to see it. You know, you have to understand it. You have to talk to Mrs. Meyer in the office, who tells you that her boss needs to sign it, and it needs to be put in the file, and the office has to have it in triplicate. And if she doesn't do it, she'll lose her job.
Just a quick one here. How are you finding it? Because I'm just going to go back to your previous example, as in you would go on the streets and just talk to people, and you have your pickup line and whatever, right? That Nina picked on. Like, can you still go to someone's home today? Like, do they trust?
I spent this whole week. I've been in four homes this week already.
Okay.
And at the beginning of the year in April, I did the same. I was going all over Berlin with clients, with interpreters, with cameramen in people's homes, interviewing them for 3 hours, 4 hours on camera with interpreters.
Yeah. And honestly, that is the thing why I'm still a researcher. And, you know, it can be stressful, blah, blah, whatever. But the thing is, being a researcher forces me to leave my bubble. You know, well, I live in a bubble. I can probably enter the apartment of my friends, and it might look alike, you know, but we all kind of do the same thing. I may be interested in the same thing. Of course, we are different, but hey, we live in a bubble. But research forces me to leave that bubble. I'm meeting people where I, in my private life, have no overlap, who I would probably never meet, who are fans of bands where I was thought that, oh really, who purchased these furnitures, were thinking like, wow, that's you. And you know, and it's all lovely people. And the research forces me to step out of my bubble and step into a different bubble to understand it. And honestly, and that's why I love research, because I think in no other job you see so much great stuff, have so amazing conversations, and it enriches my life, I have to say, you know, because I go out there and talk to all these humans.
And while we were doing it online for a while, it was still quite insightful, because you, in some ways, because if you do a focus, a group discussion or interviews with people when they're in their own home, a lot of my clients really liked it, depending on the topic. I had a client, we were talking about streaming, you know, media usage and stuff. And they loved that because you could see the living room and the, you know, the way people live and the differences. Or sometimes when a child runs through the picture and or a cat walks across, that kind of thing. But but actually getting out and, like Nina said, visiting people in their homes or meeting them in a context that is relevant to the research is just so incredibly rich. I mean, we get to go through, I've cooked with families. Yesterday I got told by, like, talking to three 16-year-olds about dealing with sneakers and what's a good invest, you know, and how, which ones to buy. And then, yeah, it's just, we see so many different, I think that's also what opens your mind. And I think if you're not that kind of person, coming back to where we started earlier, if you don't have that kind of openness and curiosity, then it's not the right job.
Yeah. I mean, that requires a lot of patience. Meeting new people, discovering stuff, killing any assumption you had.
Yeah, but you get very quick at decoding things. And as I mentioned, I said we did a lot of automotive, and one of the very things that we did then, explorative research for automotive companies. And we visited so many people at home that I got to the stage where I could tell just by, if you give me a photograph of somebody's living room, I could tell them what car they own.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is what you learn throughout the job, and don't understand me wrong here, we have to be able to build, gosh, I can't think of the English word right now.
Vertrauen.
Rapport.
Trust.
Yes.
Trust. In a millisecond.
Sorry for that one. In many seconds. And this is not about tricking people, but it's about that my interview partner who lets me, a strange woman, into their very intimate place, that they feel comfortable with it. That is a thing you learn through all these years, build rapport and trust very, very quickly. And on the other hand, I mean, that's the other side of the medal. I realize when I do a lot of research, visiting a lot of people at home, I'm so tired because I feel like my social nerve is sore. Because, like, as a good researcher, honestly, you just listen. You don't ask a lot of questions, you know, but you just listen. But it's kind of like you are like a 200% alert and giving so much social energy in there. So, yeah, that's a great thing about the job as well.
Like a goalkeeper somehow, because you have to see everything.
You feel everything, you see everything, you hear everything. At the same time, your brain is trying to make a checklist of what you've already understood and what to ask next and what you don't understand and how to fit that into the goals of the research. And, you know, it's not, you don't just sit down with them and have a conversation about their lives. You really have an agenda.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sometimes if you have clients sitting next to you and interpreters sitting next to you and focusing on that. And I came home yesterday after spending like 3 hours, 3-4 hours talking to these teenagers. And I went to bed at 9 o'clock.
Yeah. Did you have to put everything, condense everything you had, like in a few words?
You can't do that on the same day.
Oh, well, you're tired, obviously.
Yes, but you can't give an analysis of what... I was talking to my client about this morning because she was with me. We were this another topic is about how do you actually synthesize and analyze what you've learned. And I just keep looking over, I was saying the side eye of my client. My two clients were sitting right and left of the interpreter, and they were filling notebook after notebook after notebook. and I said to her, look, Karen, please don't ask me about that. About those interviews. I think four different in-homes that we did in Berlin, and we're going to Düsseldorf and Hamburg and Munich, because I can't tell you right now. Yeah. You know, it has to go through this process.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time, so can I ask one more question?
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
I want to have this last question as a tribute to Adam, because that's how we met.
Oh, yes.
Through Adam Lawrence, who was on that talks as well, 24 and 25. I think, yeah. And the question is, because we met in a context of theater for surface design, so we were kind of wrapping up with the key points that you need to have, you know, you need to gain that trust and then have fun. So how do you incorporate theater? Do you do it?
Well, I would say I don't incorporate it, but I see my job as impro theater, because it's very comparable, you know, you kind of have a goal out there where you know I want to reach that. You do have a stage with 1 to 8 people on there. You have no idea what's going to happen. You get a prompt and you have to react. So I don't use it. I have the feeling what we do is improv theater, but I'd love to use it more. You know, like really saying like, hey, play a scene or whatsoever. But right now, I rather always feel in the midst of her improv theater in my job.
I don't know if Jane wants to add anything to this.
Yeah, I just want to, what Nina said. We always used to say when we were, it seems such a long time ago before COVID, when the standard situation was a group discussion in a room with the mirror behind you and the clients behind the mirror and the interpreters in a little room on watching everything on a screen. We always said you have to play, you're doing what Nina said, which is you're acting improv with the participants because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's like you have a setting, you know, you play scenes with people that don't know that they're doing improv with you.
Yes. Good point.
And then you're acting for the people behind the mirror because they have an agenda and you are the filter. You know, I see my job as being an interpreter. I translate the reality of the customer into something that my clients can understand and use to make their business better. So you're like a kind of a conduit. So I use theater methods when I get the opportunity to do workshops, which is more in my other life. I use theater like everybody does in facilitation for like warm-ups and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Coming back to when I was a child, I always wanted to be a musical singer. That was my goal. Ooh. I love being on a stage. But I do improv. For me, improv is a sport. It's what I do to relax. It's what I do to have fun. You know, when I do it with a group of people, I think for some people like to go and play volleyball or something, and I'm not sporty, and I love language and I love the spontaneity and the creativity. So for me, if I do like 2 or 3 hours of improv with the people that I love to do it with, it's a way to unwind. It's a way that my brain gets calm because you're in the flow. You don't have to overthink. Because you don't have time to overthink.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. I know that we focused on the part of like doing research, why is it important, but we did not focus on how to put everything together and how to use, because it's a lot of things to cover. And I think it's an important topic to understand the why rather than just how you bring it all together, at least to start. I'm not saying one is more important, but I think the why is what is missing. I also like to talk about. So anything you would like to add? Anything I missed, anything you would like to wrap up with? And I'm going to be putting all your links, by the way, in the description.
I think what you just said, Maria, when you said the why and not the how, I think if you understand the why, we don't need to talk about the how. Because if you understand the why, then you will work out how to do it. When I first started in research, I thought the hardest part was actually doing the interviews, the most important part. But now I know that the most critical part of every research project is the briefing. If you know what you want to get out of it and why you're doing it, why? Then the how is easy.
I wouldn't go that far that it's easy then, but it makes it easier. but maybe one thing I would like to add, going to a different direction, but coming back to gut talks, we haven't talked about synthesis or analysis right now, but for me, that's a lot about gut as well. Because I always tell juniors or clients I'm working with, is like, when we're done with research, don't look at your notes, don't look at the recordings. Let's sit down. And what does your gut tell you? And our brains are quite well in remembering the really important things, you know, the golden quotes, the changing observations we have. And if you go into research and afterwards you sit down and read, I don't know, 200 pages of transcripts, you're never going to get to that. So if you do research and you're done, sit down with your fellow researchers and chat about it. What struck your mind? What surprised you most? What was out there that you didn't expect? And that's actually a very good North Star to what you found.
Yeah. And always ask the question, so what?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not about regurgitating what you heard and what you saw. It's like Nina said, it's you do regurgitate it, but what should come out is the answer to so what?
Yeah. And I can relate to this because you've been talking to those people for so many hours and then many of them, so you would see straight away, you would know, okay, this is what comes out of it and this is needed, and let's focus on it.
Can I just bust a myth that I think people maybe have? We don't ask people what they want. Yes. I think this is, I don't know, just in case that didn't come, because one of my favorite quotes that I, and I have it, I think on my LinkedIn profile, I don't know, is what people say, what people do, and what people say they do are entirely different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Margaret Mead, anthropologist, this is something that guides my work a lot.
Did I say ask people what they want?
No, but I just case people are listening to this, just in case they're listening to this and they think, yeah, this is great. I'm going to go and talk to people about my new product and I'm going to ask them how much would they pay for it, for example.
Yeah. And then would go ask their mom or their best friend and, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's always a not good choice.
Yeah. No, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on this podcast. It was really nice to see you again, actually.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
It starts with the gut. It ends with the gut. It's in your gut.
Gut Talks.